Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and he is back, Professor Emeritus Haley is, I never use that title though, but I do have it. Thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us connected one more time. How could we do it without you? And we say that every week, and we should. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And I am your host, Keith Haley, and we're getting ready for some interesting things tonight. You probably haven't heard anything on the news about unmasking, masking, leaks, intelligence, elections, leaks, we leaks, unleaks. We're going to have a guy tonight talk to us about leaks and insider account of the politics of intelligence. We're still trying to figure out who hacked our election and turned the whole results around from what they would have been, right? I can't remember. Was it people from Iceland or Australia? Was it China? Was it Russia? Was it Russia? Was it who knows what it was? But anyway, tonight we will get an example of some people talking about the CIA. And a good, if you want a good history of the CIA, I've probably told you before, the book I would recommend is Legacy of Ashes, and it's a nice two and a half inch thick book, and it takes them from day one up to pretty close to where we are today. So it's a kind of an interesting organization, and a little surprising you'll find when you read that book. Okay, so anyway, that's what we're going to do tonight. Remember, if you decide that you ever want a radio show, somebody asked me about that actually last week, you can have your own radio show. The Blog Talk Radio Network is available to people for free. You can sign up in literally minutes, and you could be broadcasting on a regular schedule once a week, twice a week, whatever, and it doesn't cost you a penny unless you're in prime time. We're 7 to 10 or 8 to 10 or something like that, so it costs us a little bit, but you could make your show, you know, 10 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning, or whatever it is. But it's a great, great feature, and who would have ever believed 10 years ago, 15 years ago, guess I've been doing it that long, that you could get on the internet and broadcast worldwide in streaming audio around the world, and it wouldn't cost you a penny. So any person, any interest group, any organization, whatever you're trying to promote, you can do that. And I keep hearing the ads on the radio and today about we had two more states, I think, legalize marijuana, maybe three in this last election in November. Maybe one of them even had a special election. But they're trying to get you to invest now in legal recreational marijuana. That's what they're calling. So if you send them $50, they're saying your money may turn into, who knows, money not even calculable. It will be so it will be so high. That's exactly what we need, is one more way to get high legally, right? Yeah, we sure need that. Anyway, let's go ahead and take a look at some news here tonight. That's probably a good idea. There's some things going on that are interesting, of course, all over the place. So give me a chance here to pick up some of this stuff. And we'll take a look at, I think we will. Hold on a second. Okay, there it is. We haven't talked about it, I think, according to the date, but Dayton, Ohio, for the second time this year, the coroner's office has run out of space for dead bodies due to opioid epidemic. Can you believe that? Tribune reports that the Montgomery County office had 13 bodies yesterday and 12 of them were overdoses. Can you believe that? Overdoses? And they said our lieutenant governor was going around the state talking about the addictions of her sons or something. I didn't hear it. I don't hear much from her. And I'm not sure. It might have been some other kind of drugs, but this is incredible. But the coroner, Dr. Ken Harshberger, said that they already expanded the cooler once last year because space for 36 wasn't enough. It now holds 42 people. But can you believe this, that these overdoses are just unbelievable? He says he's looking at 2,900 autopsies here in a report. He also reportedly rents refrigerated trailers that can be brought in when deaths spike. In other words, there's a new business for you, folks. If you want to change jobs, get yourself a refrigerated trailer, and you go, oh, man, isn't that terrible? But they had 2,900 autopsies. 2,000 of them were overdoses. Can you believe that? His report, his office handled fewer than 2,000 autopsies totaled in 2016. But 2,000 the next year was overdoses. Incredible, just incredible. Okay, what kind of car are you driving? You're not driving one of those little, what do they call that little thing now that's like the half of a car? Not a Fiat, no, not a Mini. Mini's a nice car, actually. It's good for tall people. Most folks don't even know that. But what is that thing called? Audrey, do you remember? I think Chrysler. No, Chrysler didn't make it. Anyway, I drove one once just to see what it was like. It's like you're sitting in a wind on the dashboard. But anyway, a new report from the Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that improving the economy has a downside. More traffic deaths. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, says that mini and small cars top their list of vehicles with the highest number of driver deaths. So what's the reason for that? I guess if you hit a great big car or a truck, your little tiny car isn't going to protect you very well. So, boy, it's, and you know, where's Ralph Nader when you need him? We need somebody to step forward. He got us the seatbelts. We need to step forward and make these cars only go a certain speed and make sure that nobody can get killed in them. I mean, we do that for, what, race cars? See that 500 crash, the one where the car flipped up in the air and all over the place? That guy didn't die. Maybe that's what we need. Anyway, let's go here to addiction overdoses. Here we go. This is a two addiction counselors at a suburban Philadelphia halfway house. Guess what? They died of opioid overdoses inside the facility on the same day. These are people treating people who have the addiction problem, and now they're doing the same thing. If anybody's wondering how bad the opioid epidemic has become, this case is frightening, says Chester County District Attorney Tom Hogan. Opioids are a monster. that is slowly consuming our population. I can't believe the number of people and kinds of people, and classes of people, and income levels of people where this is going on. It's just absolutely incredible. So we need to do something about it. Well, here's something that you could do to get rid of your your addiction. How about some counseling where you would go take goat yoga? It's the latest craze. Goat yoga is just days away from launching in Cleveland area. It actually launched, I guess, last week. People are so excited, says Tanya Torkelson. You're going to do goat yoga. Everyone's seen it on the internet. I hadn't seen it until I saw it in the newspaper, but I looked it up. And here's what you do. You do your yoga moves, which, you know, yoga, I'm a big fan of yoga. I think it has purpose, concentration, stretching, muscle development, etc. But the classes are filling up so fast that additional ones are being planned before the session launches on Friday. That would have been last Friday. Beware. It's not for the squeamish. So what happens is you do your little yoga poses, like you get down on your knees and put your head down between your legs and your arms back forward, and then a little goat climbs up on top of your back. But anyway, these goats, they will jump on you and even nibble on your clothes or mat while taking the class. So she warns people about that, but goat's a cute little animal. But some of you out there, why don't you go sign up for the goat yoga class in your community? Of course, apparently it's nationwide. And then let us know how it went your first session. We had a bicyclist killed in Cincinnati, Ohio, here just recently. You know, I'm a big bicyclist. I was out on my mountain bike today, mountain riding a trail. And he was killed, and the driver suspected of hitting him with his car admitted to taking heroin before the crash. This happened in Anderson Township on Monday a week ago. Oh, can you believe that? The guy's held on a $600,000 bond. Got to be held and never let out again. In fact, I saw a minister who happened to be African-American talking on television the other day about what we should be doing about this drug epidemic, and they brought on the Fox News psychologist or psychiatrist. They bring on, this was a psychiatrist, I think, and he was talking about the counseling. We have all these treatment programs, and this black minister, African-American minister, who had been a drug addict and became a minister and went to prison first, he said, you know what we need? Send them to prison. It changed my life. And we are getting away from that. It just makes so much sense. You can't take dope. You can't shoot people. You can't rob. You can't whatever. And when we think you're fixed, in other words, your mind is right, then we let you back out. Not before. Okay. You saw that. I never heard of this nutbag, but excuse me for using that name. It's probably unlawful. But this woman, Catherine Griffin, she actually held up a little fake head of Donald Trump, like she had cut his head off and the face was bleeding and all that. And Donald Trump's son, along with his wife, Ivanka, they were watching television, and this boy saw that. And he screamed, Mommy, 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 went to his mommy. But can you believe these creeps? I guess, is she a comedian, Audrey, do you know? Not a newscaster, I don't think. She must be a comedian, but how low can you get in life to do that? Well, here's a problem that bothers me, seriously. Chicago police suicides are going up. Report, according to the police union, Fraternal Order of Police in Chicago, there were 29.4 suicides for 100,000 cops from 2013 to 2015. The national average for police officers, when you take all individual studies into account, is 18.1. So Chicago is considerably above. Did you hear what Chicago did this past weekend, Memorial Day weekend? They decided to raid the homes of the gang members and lock them up, and I think their homicides were like half of what they normally are on that kind of weekend. They usually kill 40 or 50 people, something like that, and they cut them in half, or don't quote me on those figures, but they substantially reduced them. And what an idea. Henri, can you believe that they decided to go after the criminals and take their guns away from them and the dope stacked in their houses and the, oh my Lord, something else. All right. Are you a member of or a shopper at Best Buy? The Justice Department was sued Wednesday by a privacy group seeking information on the FBI's alleged recruitment of Best Buy employees to search consumer computers for child pornography during the repairs. So you take your little tablet in for repair, and Best Buy folks have been contracted with the FBI, and they look at your hard drive and find out what's in there. Of course, we should seriously be enforcing laws against child pornography, but, you know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they don't think they should be doing it this way, right? I mean, get a warrant if you have, I mean, the law covers that and it's done in other places, but I can't believe that. So think about what you're taking to Best Buy. Who knows what else the FBI is looking for besides porn offenses. But anyway, that's something. Columbus, Ohio. Let's get here local in our state. Some people actually listen to our show that are in this state. They say 14 people were killed on Ohio roads over Memorial Day weekend. And guess what? The statement says the deaths reported over the four-day period included one motorcyclist, six motorists, and seven pedestrians. Can you believe that? People don't even think about that being hit by a car. These dopes running these red lights, and I can't believe. I mean, if you're using a walk light in a downtown somewhere, I've seen it, the town I live, and it says you can walk, and you got 28 seconds, 24, whatever. Some other dope makes a right turn and, hits you or almost hit you. I've run from them myself, that type of thing. But anyway, state troopers made 554. Guess what? Drug-related arrests this year, up 26%. Can you believe that? Over a fourth increase compared with 2016. And a total of 801 DUI arrests were reported. But that is just unbelievable. Okay, what are the news that I got for you? Police, Justice Department, Coast Desk, we got that. Trying to get you to invest in medical marijuana. No, I'm not. I'm kidding. Don't believe that. Anyway, that's enough news for this evening. So we're trying to save the planet. You saw that President Trump announced about 3:30 this afternoon that he's withdrawing the United States from the climate control agreement where they met in Paris this year, because America's been substantial. We got all kinds of penalties against us, and these other nations got to 2030 or something to even do anything. I think China's one of those. And the president says, we'll go back in it, but we'll negotiate it where it doesn't knock off our jobs, kill our, China's opening up how many coal mines, and we're not allowed to have any under this climate control thing. And it's not a treaty, by the way. People don't get that. News has even covered that poorly. I mean, it's not something like we broke a treaty. We just stepped out of this thing. And anyway, we have a green tip for tonight, because you got to remember, the planet's getting warmer. Or is it? I don't. Here's a green idea that'll help all you. Oh, excuse me, Audrey, I almost said something offensive, that will help all of you that can't stop texting and using your cell phone. It's a green idea that gives you a great hand workout as well. Can you believe that? You can now text and get a physical workout too. Charge your iPhone by a hand grip. This concept is called You Can Work It Out, and it was designed by Mac Funamizu, he did that. So you can now get a phone charger where you can squeeze your hand and keep your phone charged. Where are we going, folks? Now, you know, I try to live according to that. You know, I don't want the planet to get warmer and get destroyed in the year 2416 when I'll still be here. No, I won't still be here. But I sometimes I can't decide what to do, like straws. I like to have a straw in my drink when I go to McDonald's or Arby's or someplace like that. Am I allowed to use, should I use plastic straws and then go wash them out, or should I use paper straws? When we make the plastic, does that destroy the planet more? Or when we use the paper, we can only use it once? I mean, then we have to get more paper? If you can help me solve that, let me know. And then, you know, Governor Brown in California, he's got it right. He showers once a month. I think it's once a month. And you know, I can't figure out how often should I bathe. I usually do one a day and maybe sometimes two. And now, my gosh, you know, is once a year enough? Probably was for a caveman and woman. Anyway, that's what's going on. So that's our green tip for tonight. We do have a blonde joke, and this one is about diet. What do you think about that? It says a blonde is overweight, so her doctor puts her on a diet. Says, I want you to eat regularly for 2 days, then skip a day, and repeat for 2 weeks, and you'll lose at least 5 pounds. When the blonde returns, she's lost nearly 20 pounds. The doctor exclaims, that's amazing. Did you follow my diet? The blonde nods. Yeah, yes, did. I thought I was going to drop dead every third day because of all that skipping. So every third day, skip, and you're going to lose weight. And the blonde skipped all day. It was a blind man, by the way. Okay. That's how I like it. Okay, I think what we're going to do now is take a listen to yes, Audrey, that's correct. And we're going to take a listen to our speaker for tonight, Melvin Goodman, and he's going to talk to us about his book, Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. I think you'll find this kind of interesting. He doesn't talk very long, but we'll go ahead and get him set up. So give me time here to get this thing rolling. Hold on a second. It's clogging up here a little bit. Okay. I'm sorry, hold on, it's clogging up here. I've got a good computer, I got a Mac, hold on. Gosh. You don't connect.
With more live coverage of the 8th Annual Gettysburg Book Festival. Melvin Goodman will talk about his time with the CIA.
Welcome to the Gettysburg Book Festival. My name is Audrey Bastian, and I am a Washington Independent Review of Books representative here helping at this festival. Gettysburg is a city that proudly supports the arts and humanities. We are pleased to bring you this fabulous event, thanks in part to the generous support of our buying books. This is a free event, but it does help the book festival if you buy a book. Project at the Center for International Relations at the National War College for 18 years. He served in the U.S. Army in Athens, Greece for 3 years. Purchasing books from our partner, Politics and Prose, helps support one of the world's greatest independent bookstores. And it benefits our local economy and supports local jobs. So if you're enjoying this program, we hope that you'll buy a book today, or several books. Milton Goodman was a Soviet analyst at the CIA and the Department of State for 24 years and a professor of international relations at the National War College for 18 years. He served in the U.S. Army in Athens, Greece for 3 years and was intelligence advisor to the SALT delegation from 1971 to 1972. Currently, Goodman is the director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is Whistleblower at the CIA, an Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. He also co-authored and edited 7 books, including National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, published by City Light, Gorbachev's Retreat, The Third World, The Wars of Edward Shevardnadze, thank you. The Phantom Defense, America's Pursuit of the Star Wars Illusion, Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk, and Failure of Intelligence, the Decline and Fall of the CIA. His articles and op-eds have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, Harper's Foreign Policy, Foreign Service Journal, the Baltimore Sun, and the Washington Post, and he lives in Bethesda, Maryland. I have been reading his book, and it's very interesting. I was once recruited for the CIA, and I found this very interesting. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And it's nice to be back here again, especially when it's not raining. I was here 3 years ago with National Insecurity, and this is a wonderful festival and just a wonderful event. I'll start with May the 8th. 2017, which is a very important date for two reasons. One reason, that's when the book came out. And it was important to me because I had to submit it to the CIA for review as part of my contract with the CIA. It took them 11 months to review this book. Now, I know they're slow reading, but I think that goes beyond the limit and raises a real right to speak or freedom of speech issue that I'll get to maybe at the end of the talk. The other reason why May the 8th, 2017, is very important to me is because that's the day Sally Yates testified. I found her testimony riveting. And it was riveting on several levels, but the most important level to me and why I have such incredible respect for that woman is the highest duty of any public servant at any level of government is to expose misconduct, is to tell the truth when it comes to matters of legality or morality or simple transgression or misconduct. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book, this particular book, was basically to tell my story. And the story is a simple one in a sense. I spent 42 years with the government. When you look at my service in the Army, in the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, in the Department of State. Throughout that entire period, the 42-year period, I had security clearances at the highest level. So I know what security is. I know about the importance of security. But I also learned over a period of time, and not that you don't enter public service to become a dissident, let alone a whistleblower, but I also learned the incredible misuse of intelligence. And just on one level, think about the fact that in our history, there have been 4 wars that we have fought where intelligence was used in a dishonest way to justify the use of force. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War, of course, it's obvious. And then one of the worst examples of all, which I dealt with in my earlier books, was the Iraq War, which was a total misuse of intelligence, a total lie in terms of everything the American public was told. Now, another reason why I decided to write the book was the importance of the whistleblower. And I don't like the term whistleblower. I've never liked it. It has a very bad connotation. it has the connotation of a snitch or a rat pig or a stoolie. And that is not what a whistleblower is all about. And I give a certain amount of credit, even though I'm disturbed by what Ralph Nader did in the year 2000. But it was Ralph Nader who I think made the word whistleblower respectable from his writings in the 1970s. And that's extremely important. But when you think about a whistleblower in terms of some of the great disasters we've had to deal with in just the last 30, 40 years of our own experience, think of the role of the whistleblower in Watergate. Now, I know all the credit goes to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, and they deserve the credit. Very little credit or fame ever goes to the whistleblower, in this case, Mark Felt. And one of the interesting things about Mark Felt was when the White House, the Nixon White House, was first dealing with the problem that there were serious leaks that had to come from the top. And remember, the United States is the ship of state that leaks from the top, not from the bottom. Haldeman knew it was Mark Felt. He told Richard Nixon that I think it's Mark Felt over at the FBI, the deputy at the FBI. And Nixon's first response was, is he Jewish? And Haldeman responded, no, I think he's Catholic. I don't know what either one would have to do with it, but the role of Mark Felt in the case of Watergate is extremely significant. When I think of Vietnam, I don't know what the first thought that comes to your mind is. It's the Pentagon Papers. And when I think of the Pentagon Papers, I think of Daniel Ellsberg and the work that Daniel Ellsberg did in the 1970s and continues to do, including writing a very nice blurb for the book that I'm very proud of. And in June, I'm going to appear with Daniel Ellsberg in Berkeley at an event to talk about whistleblowers in this particular book. When you think of the scandals of torture and abuse, think of the need for the whistleblower. When you think of Abu Ghraib, the torture and abuse that took place at a military prison, that involved a whistleblower. I know Edward Snowden is extremely controversial, and it's clear that Edward Snowden broke laws. Edward Snowden has admitted to the fact that he has broken certain laws dealing with certain kinds of intelligence, communications intelligence, and signals intelligence. But Edward Snowden also told us about unconstitutional, not just illegal, but unconstitutional behavior in the White House that was aimed at all of the American people. This was an important contribution to our understanding. And here is where whistleblowers, I think, play a very important role. We've just read about Chelsea Manning being released from jail. She received a pardon from President Obama. And I know there's a lot of confusion and controversy about Chelsea Manning, but the fact of the matter is she exposed war crimes that were taking place in Iraq. And my point is, in trying to understand what a whistleblower is and why a whistleblower acts the way he does, and I can only speak for myself, but I think I know why these people acted the way they did. You see something in public life at some point that you know is wrong. And sometimes it becomes so overwhelming that you feel that you have to do something about it. And I think mostly whistleblowers, and I know again in my case, are extremely naive about what it means to throw yourself in front of a moving train, which is the American government. And in my case, it was throwing myself in front of the nomination of Robert Gates as a CIA director in 1991 when I testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is what motivates a whistleblower. You reach a point where it's wrong not to say something. It's wrong not to do something. And I must say, in all of the whistleblower examples that I cite in the book and that I've looked at, tried to understand, every whistleblower, as far as I'm concerned, has been vindicated. Daniel Ellsberg has certainly been vindicated. Edward Snowden, for a lot of us, including myself, clearly has been vindicated. I know it's controversial that he left the country, but I think he left the country because of the terrible treatment that Thomas Drake received. And I don't know if everyone is familiar with the Thomas Drake case, but he is the National Security Agency whistleblower who was then accused of violating the Espionage Act from 1970 by the Obama administration. And what I find interesting about that issue was put before the Bush administration. And George W. Bush, who was vilified in many quarters, decided he would not go after Thomas Drake. But Barack Obama, a Harvard-trained lawyer and someone who taught constitutional law, did allow the government to go after Thomas Drake in the worst possible way, threatening him with basically spending the rest of his life in prison until a judge lectured the Justice Department lawyers and threw the case out of court, essentially. Let me spend a few minutes on my particular example. It's not as dramatic as Snowden's or Drake's, and certainly not Ellsberg's, and some of the other whistleblower cases that I've looked at. But in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan came into office and he appointed an extreme ideologue to be the CIA director, William Casey, this was when I first had to confront the politicization of intelligence. And what it amounted to was the fact that Ronald Reagan wanted to increase defense spending in an unprecedented way at peacetime. We had never seen these kinds of increases before in peacetime. To do that, you had to justify it. You had to have an enemy. You had to have a threat. And what Casey did, and his deputy, Robert Gates, who then went on to become a CIA director and then a Secretary of Defense under both Bush and Obama, was to distort the intelligence, to make the Soviet Union look 10 feet tall, the Soviet Union as a threat, the Soviet Union involved in the attempt to assassinate the Pope in 1981, the Soviet Union involved in international terrorism. None of this was true. And I stayed throughout the early 80s and basically fought these issues, but in 1986 I decided to leave and go to the National War College to teach. And in 1991, when Bob Gates was nominated by George H.W. Bush to be the CIA director, that's when I contacted the Senate Intelligence Committee and testified against the Gates nomination. Now, what was interesting about the Gates nomination is that's not the first time he was nominated. He was nominated for the first time in 1987 by Ronald Reagan. This was after the sudden death of Bill Casey from a brain tumor. Gates went before the Senate Intelligence Committee and then got a call at night from David Boren, Senator Boren from Oklahoma, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who had to tell Bob, "You've got a problem, Bob. The committee does not believe you in terms of your disavowals of knowing anything or being involved in Iran-Contra. I can't get your name out of the committee." And Bob Gates went into the White House the next day, talked to Frank Carlucci, and then talked to the president and pulled his name out. But 4 years later, he was nominated again. It was a very controversial nomination because of my accusations of politicization. It led to more votes against Bob Gates than had been registered against all CIA directors combined, going back to 1947 and Harry Truman's creation of the CIA. But he was eventually confirmed. And what this meant is someone who had politicized intelligence was sent back to run the agency where the politicization takes place. Unless you've been involved in this in one of the government agencies, you cannot imagine the morale problems and the ethical problems are created when someone you know who was involved with politicization comes back to run the agency. That's why I have so much sympathy for what is going on now, I'm sure, in probably every department, every agency in government, when you have a president who has selected cabinet directors who have sworn essentially to, if not destroy the departments they've been sent to, certainly to weaken them in every fundamental way. So that was essentially my reason for going before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And then being disappointed by the way it was handled by the press, which I thought did not rise to the challenge. And I'll give you one anecdote, which I think reveals what is wrong with the press, even though they've certainly gotten their act together in the last 120 days. So the White House started to leak very uncomplimentary things about me, I should say. None of them were true, and CIA people who were called denied all the stories, and I was tipped off by a couple of journalists, one from Time Magazine, one from the Washington Post. But I decided, damn, you can play this thing. So I started leaking, and I leaked to Ben Weiser of the Washington Post, who's now with the New York Times, and Elaine Shilino from the New York Times. So these are the two papers that have the most clout, certainly, in Washington, as they do today. And for the first several days of the testimony, Elaine Shilino played it straight in the New York Times. She reported what I was telling her. She reported what the White House was telling her. There was a certain amount of false equivalence, but she was representing both sides. Midway in the confirmation hearings, her reporting tilted completely to benefit Bob Gates and his nomination and his confirmation. And after the hearings were over and he was confirmed, I called Elaine to have lunch. I had an agenda. And halfway through the lunch, I raised my agenda item, which was, why was it so obvious that halfway through the confirmation hearings, you abandoned what I was telling you, which was pretty good inside information of what was happening in the Senate Intelligence Committee? And she said, well, I'll tell you, it was clear at that point that he was going to be confirmed and he would become the CIA director and a very important source for me. You would go back to teaching at the National War College and I'd probably never call you again. And I thought, this told me all I needed to know about what is wrong with the mainstream media. And when you think of whistleblowers, and I'll pick on the Washington Post, it's our hometown newspaper. If you go back to the op-eds of the Washington Post on all of the whistleblowers, Edward Snowden, Thomas Drake, Chelsea Manning, look up the critical articles that were written about them by people like Richard Cohen, Ruth Marcus, David Ignatius, Walter Pincus, Fred Hyatt, the editor of the editorial page. And it was always very meaningful to me that journalism, investigative journalism, which relies on whistleblowers, you know, where would investigative journalism be? Think of Dana Priest of the Washington Post, who won a Pulitzer Prize. Well, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her stories about secret prisons that the CIA was operating in Europe and Southeast Asia. She got that information from a whistleblower. To this day, we still don't know who that whistleblower was. We know a lot about Dana because she won a Pulitzer Prize for her work, but the whistleblower is an anonymous person. But yet, when you read the op-eds, I remember the one that I found the most offensive was Ruth Marcus, who referred to Chelsea Manning as a cross-dressing Red Riding Hood. David Ignatius was very ugly with his comments about Edward Snowden. David Gregory, when he ran Meet the Press, had Glenn Greenwald on his show. It was extremely critical for Glenn Greenwald being a conduit for the information that Edward Snowden provided. When Senator Dianne Feinstein wrote an incredibly authoritative report on CIA torture and abuse, she was on Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room and accused of having blood on her hands for revealing all that information about CIA torture and abuse. So the thing I would like to leave you with at this point, because I do want to leave some time for your questions and comments, is our democracy right now is in trouble. We're in a very beleaguered state. There was an article in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago about, I love this word, guardrails, the guardrails of democracy and how the system is working. Well, two observations. One, the system will only work if people make the system work. The system can't work on its own. And two, I would argue the system isn't working the way I would like it to work. Look at the intelligence committees that were created in the 1970s because of the crimes during the Vietnam era, 30 years after the CIA was created. The Senate Intelligence Committee is not doing the aggressive job it should be doing. It's not bipartisan. Republican Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina is not doing the work that an intelligence chairman needs to do. And I don't even have to say anything about Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, and the way he was used as a stooge by the White House, being brought into the White House grounds and giving sex to the documents and told to deliver these to the President of the United States as if this was new information to the President of the United States. I think of the inspectors general of the various agencies, an extremely important post that was weakened by Barack Obama. Most of the 8 years that Obama was in office, the CIA went without an inspector general. When I think of Hillary Clinton and the email problem, and frankly the email problem and Comey's handling of the email problem is probably the decisive reason why Hillary Clinton was defeated, even though there are other factors that need to be addressed. But Hillary Clinton never allowed a permanent inspector general to be in the State Department the 4 years she was there. What if there had been an inspector general who very early on could have called attention to the fact that the idea of having your own email account and putting a server in your home is probably not the best idea in the world? The press, which I think has suddenly got its act together and certainly has been very aggressive with its reporting in the last 120 days, did not do its job during the campaign. The false equivalents the free ride that Donald Trump got from leaving the Washington Post and the New York Times was really an embarrassment. And I think most major editors around the country understand that now. When I look at the court system, the federal courts have not been aggressive in matters dealing with national security, where they give a lot of benefit of the doubt to the government and the state secrets privilege, or making people create their own legal standing for bringing a case to a federal court. So it's important that citizens understand that these so-called guardrails have to be fortified, and that there should be a certain amount of understanding of what a whistleblower is and what a whistleblower does. And going back to warnings that we've gotten from people such as James Madison and Alexander Hamilton about the importance of a free press, the importance of not trading off your liberty for security, and the importance of a public service who exposes misconduct, I think these are things we have to keep in mind. So we have less than 10 minutes. Let's open it up.
The use of whistleblowers is unique to this country, because without our free press, wouldn't we be just no different than the Soviet Union, China, or any other dictatorship?
Well, I certainly don't think it's unique to us. And frankly, there are Soviet citizens and Russian citizens who have taken far more risk with their lives. You know, during the worst of the hearings, I tended to look under the hood of my car before I started my engine, but I really didn't think my life was threatened. But in places such as Russia and China, whistleblowers take tremendous risk. In Britain, you had important whistleblowers dealing with Tony Blair's dishonesty in joining up with George Bush in the Iraq War. What is unique about the United States, I think, and I worry about this uniqueness, is the court system and the investigative journalism when it works, people like Seymour Hersh, Tony Lewis when he was alive with the New York Times, James Risen with the New York Times, Greg Miller from the Post does a very good job. But I notice now, and I don't know when it got there, but the masthead in the Washington Post, and it was probably after Trump's election or inauguration, "Democracy Dies in Darkness." Go back and read Sinclair Lewis's "It Can't Happen Here," which was written in the 1930s, it's happening here. Yeah.
I think I heard you say earlier that the primary responsibility of a civil servant is to expose wrongdoing. Is that correct?
I did.
Is that
Alexander Hamilton, by the way, planted that seed in my mind.
Okay, well, that probably answered my question. My question was, should that be the norm, or is that an outcome of current times? In other words, shouldn't the primary responsibility be to do good as opposed to looking for wrongdoing?
Oh, well, I take doing good for granted.
Okay.
I mean, why would you do any task, whether with the government or outside the government, if you weren't having a beneficial effect? But when you get beyond what are the standard obligations of a public servant or anyone else, I think truthfulness in confronting wrongdoing is important. And remember, it was Alexander Hamilton, and I always go back to Hamilton first before I read any of the other founding fathers because there's so much wisdom there. He talked about impeachment in terms of the number one offense that has to be addressed is compromising the public trust. And certainly we see too much of that, whether it was Nixon, whether it was Reagan in Iran-Contra in the 1980s, which, of course, is very controversial, but still I think he did compromise the public trust. And now look what we're dealing with day after day. Dina, yeah. I think there's a mic coming.
Yeah. What's the relationship between resigning in protest and whistleblowing? I once wrote an article on this subject, so I'm kind of interested. I think there's some relationship.
Well, there's a relationship because, by definition, when you resign in protest, you've made yourself a whistleblower. The problem is there's so few of either variety. You know, who resigns in protest? I think during Vietnam, there were some brave Foreign Service officers. I think of my good friend Robert White, the ambassador in El Salvador, when the church women were raped and murdered, and Alexander Haig, the Secretary of State, said, we want this covered up. We don't want to investigate it. And Bob White, being the kind of person he was, did not let go. I think of Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State for Jimmy Carter, after the debacle of the Iran hostage rescue in 1979-1980, who told the president, I'm opposed to what you're doing. Whether it succeeds or fails, I'm going to resign because I think what you're doing is wrong, but I'm not going to call attention to it until the operation takes place. And, of course, it was a failure. But how many people like that act on principle or protect a morality or honor their moral compass? The sad thing is, and I'll throw this out as a warning, if anyone thinks he's going to be a whistleblower, you know who you are. Don't expect when you turn around at the end of the day that you're going to have a big gathering, some platoon in back of you. You're going to have very little support. Most people run from that kind of controversy. That's just a fact of life. Yeah. There's a mic right there.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Do you think that Mueller is going to be able to do a very comprehensive investigation, or is that going to be compromised?
I think Mueller was probably the best choice that this current situation could have allowed for. I think the power of the press was important because Ron Rosenstein, who a lot of us had come to respect from his work in Maryland over the last 20 years, clearly bowed to pressure in writing that ridiculous memo he wrote against Comey. He was a stooge. He was part of the paper trail for a firing that never should have taken place. But my warning about these investigations, one, they take a very long time, particularly counterintelligence investigations. Two, they don't always tell us everything that we need to know. And three, I don't think they ever really get to the bottom of things. And now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but remember going back to the Kennedy assassination and the Warren investigation, there's still a lot of loose ends. Look at the Iran-Contra investigation, which took 6 years. And I got into a lot of trouble when I testified because Warren Rudman, a very bombastic senator from New Hampshire, who is co-chairman of the Iran-Contra investigation, I blistered the work of the Iran-Contra investigation because they didn't get to the bottom of what happened. So I'm hopeful that what the FBI will do now under Mueller will light some fire under the House and the Senate. But remember, until the Republicans start losing some seats somewhere, and this test in Georgia next month is going to be very interesting, I don't think they're going to do the right thing. They've got their man in the White House, and they're going to hang on to him for as long as possible. So don't think that great things are going to happen, and they're not going to happen in the near term. Yeah.
This is more of an observation than a commendation for your words today. I'm a member of the media. I covered the presidential election, and I am being a whistleblower on the media, thanks to your inspiration, because I do believe the term that you used, false equivalency, guilty. The media gave a false equivalency to the candidates, in particular Donald Trump, especially because at the beginning he was more of a curiosity. And he was good for ratings on television. And I think the result is that the media did not do its job. And as a member of that media, I feel very badly about that. It's very hard to just be one person in the mass media and make a difference. But when you talk about whistleblowing, you realize maybe that could have happened. And now this false equivalency has led us to a situation where we have a democracy that's in crisis, and we have special prosecutors, and we have all of these situations that we've never seen before. And I just wanted to commend you for using the term false equivalency because it's extremely accurate in this situation in particular. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if we have time for one more. just while we're waiting, remember the president of CBS who said that Donald Trump is great for business and it was good for the bottom line. And I thought it was very interesting that Edward Snowden made sure that his information did not get to the New York Times because of the poor way they handled the Iraq War, Judith Miller and Michael Gordon, who distorted the news that they received.
I think that's a pretty good place to stop. I think you've got this gentleman's perspective, don't you? Do you think it's fair? I think it's incredible that the assumptions that he makes, and I guess he's probably still going to accept his federal retirement, though, right? He probably waited long enough to bow out as the whistleblower and collect his federal retirement. But anyway, this particular book session was not balanced and fair. What the woman media person just said, we ought to be fair in so many words, or in other words, and it doesn't sound like she was. But anyway, what do you think? That sounds like that's enough for tonight. So what we're going to do is finish up here with Vera Lynn singing We'll Meet Again. And I wanted to recommend to you, I just saw it this week, you can just YouTube it or Google it on YouTube or whatever they call it. But search on YouTube and look for the 1 hour show. I think it's 59 minutes or an hour, 9 minutes about Vera Lynn and her life. And what a human being, what a loving human being going to all those countries during the Second World War. And, doing singing and helping orphans and all kinds of stuff. I mean, just absolutely incredible. And then over 90 years old, still singing, and was just incredible. And she was really dedicated loyalist to the soldiers that were fighting the terrible Second World War. But anyway, here's Vera Lynn and singing. We'll meet again, and we'll see you next week.
Don't know where, don't know what.